This is The Meaning of Green, Season 3. I'm Vivian Thompson. In Season 1 of The Meaning of Green, my guests and I examined how we've managed to solve or not to solve major environmental problems like acid rain and leaded gasoline. And we applied the policy lessons we had learned to climate change. Season 2 investigated the links between power, freedom, and the environment, and whether those links shed light on the coronavirus's emergence and spread. Season 3's overarching theme is place and the environment. We'll travel to different locations in the United States and around the world, characterize their environmental issues and possible remedies, and explore connections with other places. This podcast is independently produced in Cedar Closet Studios in Charlottesville, Virginia, and has no sponsor. No outside entity influences the content of The Meaning of Green. Before I started The Meaning of Green, I was for 20 years a professor of environmental policy at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. My experience is not just academic, though. I've also been an environmental regulatory official in Virginia and at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. My 3 published books are about garbage transport, climate change policy in the U.S., Brazil, and Germany, and about who wields power and how when we regulate air pollution. You can find out more about The Meaning of Green and find links for all podcast episodes at the podcast's website, meaningofgreen.com. This episode is the second in a 2-part series that focuses on 2 communities in my home state of Virginia that have been plagued by dust flying from trucks or rail cars carrying coal. Those 2 communities, Rhoda in Wise County and Lamberts Point in Norfolk, lie at opposite edges of Virginia's southern border. Rhoda is in the state's rural mountainous southwest, and Lamberts Point is in the state's urban maritime southeast. Both communities are vulnerable socioeconomically, but the residents of both places have not been afraid to demand clean air. Rhoda is overwhelmingly white, and Lamberts Point is between 40 and 45% African American. You should listen first to part 1, Coal Dust is Black, because it sets the stage for this episode. Part 1 describes some of the distinctive features of Rhoda and Lamberts Point. It describes briefly the kinds of racist housing practices like redlining, constrained mobility, wealth accumulation, and opportunities for African Americans in Norfolk and elsewhere in the U.S. Part 1 reviews the health impacts of inhalable particulate matter and highlights the disproportionate impact of particulate matter on people of color and those with low income. And it tells the story of Rhoda, which unfolded between 2008 and 2010, when I was a member of the Virginia Air Pollution Control Board. This episode, The Power Game, focuses on Lamberts Point, which is in Norfolk. At the end of this episode, we'll link Rhoda and Lamberts Point with insights about how power has been wielded in those cases. In The Power Game, we unmask power's various disguises in the public policy arena. You can apply the Power Game's ideas wherever you happen to live. As far as I'm concerned, the Lamberts Point situation should have come before the Air Board when I was a member. To be sure, the Air Board's agenda was jam-packed with contentious decisions. In 2 crucial cases involving coal-fired power plants, courts upheld the Air Board's standards, which were more restrictive than those advocated by state environmental officials. So we didn't have a lot of spare time, but as I look at the Lamberts Point coal dust problem, which has persisted for decades, I wish I could turn back the clock and bring that issue to the Air Board of 15 years ago. Carl Poole, the Norfolk resident and activist for New Virginia Majority we met in Part 1, helps paint a picture of the Lamberts Point community. ODU is Old Dominion University.
Well, from what I understand about Lamberts Point, it's a community that was born right along with the forerunner to Norfolk Southern. It was a working class community, always has really been a working class community. In fact, it grew up and started by being populated by folks who worked for the railroad. That's where the majority of their workers, that's where the majority of their folks that worked on that line and worked for there, not just early in the 20th century, but the end of the 19th century, where they lived. mostly white, in the 40s and the 50s, the neighborhood changed. You had more black people moving into that neighborhood after World War II. And like a lot of neighborhoods that had a majority of black people, it was redlined. That's nothing new in Norfolk. It's a jigsaw puzzle of neighborhoods that got redlined back in the 40s and the 50s. Despite this, it's still a working class neighborhood. Many of the people who live there, they have jobs that you have to take a shower after work. And even though they also are right next to ODU, and there's been some gentrification, and some of the housing that's in Lambert's Point has been converted into like private student housing, it is still very much a working class neighborhood. You can tell that just by walking through it.
Before we tackle the question of dust in Lambert's Point, we must talk about the elevated health risks to African American communities created by redlining and forced segregation. In the 1930s, the federal government instituted a loan system intended to help rescue homeowners from mortgage default. That color-coded system shaded many African American communities red, thereby preventing the residents of those areas from qualifying for home loans. Today, formerly redlined areas are less likely to have green space, and a lack of green space is associated with hotter temperatures, more noise pollution, poorer air quality, and lower income. Further, a significant body of research shows that segregation in and of itself threatens the health of African Americans. Those differential impacts stem from closer proximity to polluting sources, fewer opportunities for mobility, financial instability, chronic discrimination, inadequate health care, and a host of psychosocial stressors. The dust problem in Lambert's Point and in other neighborhoods like Larchmont and West Ghent comes from rail cars that bring coal to the Norfolk Southern Rail Terminal, where the coal is loaded onto ships for transport all around the world. A lot of coal cars pass into that rail yard. Let's calculate roughly how many that might be. I found industry reports on Lambert's Point coal exports for 2018 through 2020, and combine those reports with a government estimate on average tons of coal carried per rail car. In those 3 years, according to my figures, an average of 343 coal rail cars per day passed by the people closest to the rail lines. A Norfolk Southern video posted on YouTube in 2011 shows that the coal at Lambert's Point is subsequently dumped into waiting bins, blended according to customers' specifications, and then loaded onto waiting ships. The video depicts multiple opportunities for coal dust to be entrained into the air. Complaints about coal dust flying from rail cars in Virginia, not just in Lambert's Point, stretch back to at least the 1970s. A 1997 report from Virginia's state legislature says that, at times, clouds of coal dust 40 feet high billowed up from rail cars, forcing automobiles to pull off nearby roads or turn on their lights. In 1991, state legislators tried but failed to pass a law requiring that coal rail cars be covered. That legislation failed because of cost estimates submitted by Norfolk Southern. So, legislators studied the problem. In their 1997 report, they indicated that, to reduce the dust problem, Norfolk Southern and coal companies had agreed to use chemical sealants and to change the way the cars were loaded. At the time, the dust was referred to as a nuisance, not as a public health threat. But even at the time, one high-ranking state environmental official, Ramon Minx, was convinced that coal dust from the Lambert's Point facility needed to be regulated as an air pollutant. He identified several possible control methods, like covering the cars with tarps and enclosing the area where coal is dumped from freight cars and loaded onto ships. In a 1993 interview with a local newspaper, the Virginian Pilot, Mr. Minx said he retired because he was so frustrated with Norfolk Southern's intransigence and with his inability to overcome resistance by state politicians. Mr. Minx, who directed the state's local air pollution office, was quoted as saying that Norfolk Southern was the most difficult organization to work with that I ever encountered. And he said that, quote, "There was political pressure to stop us. I took early retirement rather than put up with what I saw as deliberate deceit on the part of the people who were appointed above me." Carl Poole has this to say about Norfolk Southern's reaction to the coal dust situation.
We have written them letters. We have Christmas caroled in front of their headquarters. We've asked for calls, meetings. I think the attitude from Norfolk Southern on the whole is indifference. We're, you know, one little community group in one little small area right next to them in the city for which they're named for, and they still have a lot of pull in. We can be annoying. We can make some noise. But thus far, the real power in what we've been doing is, one, taking it to city leaders, taking it to Virginia House of Delegate leaders, getting their attention and trying to get what our concerns are focused in legislation. We've even had members go up to Richmond in order to speak during committees to get their attention. Now, directly, maybe Norfolk Southern doesn't listen, but screaming at a fence at folks working at a rail yard isn't going to get them to respond to us. We've got to do something else. We have to do something more for them to do the minimum. Covering their coal cars is something that we were very interested in seeing get done. Their response, I believe at one point they put out that they're now using some kind of chemical spray residue that's designed to reduce the amount of coal dust that may come off of the loaded car after they've loaded it with one of the dumpers. That's some action, but I think for the most part, they kind of look at us like, oh, we're just these little guys in a neighborhood and we're not going to worry too much about us. That might be a mistake on their part.
The information we have about particulate matter levels near the rail terminal leaves a lot of questions unanswered. According to a Norfolk Southern monitoring study conducted from 2015 to 2016, levels of inhalable particulate matter called PM10 were lower than EPA's air quality standard. PM10 consists of particles up to 10 microns in diameter. But in evaluating the study, a state health official said PM2.5 samples are preferred to fully understand the impact particle matter may have on health. PM2.5, or fine particulate matter, consists of particles 2.5 microns and smaller. So why didn't Norfolk Southern monitor for PM2.5? Interestingly, this study happened after coal exports from the Lamberts Point terminal had dropped by about a third from the previous year. A study conducted by the company, not an outside expert, at a time of relatively low throughput and that missed the main pollutant of concern, is hard to take seriously. In Norfolk, the state of Virginia's permanent air quality monitor shows that EPA's fine particulate matter standards are being met. But we learned in part one from the Rota story that permanent regional monitors are not designed to measure locally high pollution levels. Data scientists have estimated air quality levels where permanent air quality monitors are not located, using satellite data, models, and measured air quality levels. An atmospheric scientist colleague passed along such estimates for Lamberts Point. Those estimates show a steady decline in PM2.5 levels since 2005 and that EPA's standards are being met in Lamberts Point. But my colleague pointed out that those estimates might well miss dust flying from rail cars. Further, EPA is reevaluating its particulate matter standards because of research demonstrating adverse health effects below the current standards. In part one of this episode, Dr. Francesca Domenici of Harvard University stressed the connection between long-term exposures to fine particulate matter and premature mortality, and that minorities and those with low income suffer the highest risks of dying prematurely from fine particulate matter exposures. Her findings further indicate that African Americans continue to be exposed to higher fine particulate matter levels than whites. Dr. Domenici's team has connected a one-unit increase in long-term exposures to PM2.5 with an 8% increase in the COVID-19 mortality rate, which, in Virginia, as elsewhere, is much higher for minorities. Recent work has also shown that for African Americans, segregation magnifies the impacts of PM2.5 exposures on cardiovascular disease. Dr. Rachel Morello-Frosch of UC Berkeley has documented the special vulnerability of pregnant African-American women to particulate matter levels. She summarized her research in a 2020 talk sponsored by the ISEE Global Education Channel.
Again, here's an example of a study that we did a long time ago, leveraging birth data in California. And so we looked at births over a 10-year period, and what we found was an average of about a 10-gram decrement in birth weight per unit change in PM2.5 level overall for the population in California. But the other thing that we saw was that this effect was most dramatic for African-American mothers, both for PM2.5 and for coarse PM, but also for PM10. This suggests that these racial differences are not necessarily, they are not due to inherent biological differences in terms of socially defined racial categories, but it does suggest that there is susceptibility factors that are likely to be at play where African-American mothers are more vulnerable to the adverse birth weight effects of air pollution compared to other women in the state.
We know that the rail terminal's coal dust has affected soils near the rail yard from a study published in 2007 by Professor Karen Johansson. She is a geochemistry professor at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Professor Johansson found high coal dust levels in soils near Norfolk Southern's rail yard, and soil arsenic levels were elevated by as much as 5 times over background levels. She concluded that the rail yard was, quote, a significant source of particulate coal to the local environment, and further, that this coal contributes arsenic to the local soils, end quote. Arsenic is a human carcinogen. What Professor Johansson's work points to is the need to consider accumulated risks not only over time, but across different kinds of pollutants and kinds of exposures. Any diesel locomotives coming into the terminal are also polluting the air with diesel combustion pollution, which is classified as a human carcinogen. Well, we should know more in the next year or so about the air quality at Lambert's Point and in surrounding neighborhoods. In 2020, the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality was awarded a $500,000 grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to assess air quality near the Norfolk Southern Rail Terminal. The goal of DEQ's study, which commenced in early 2021, is to quantify air levels of fine particulate matter and trace toxics like arsenic and chromium near the Lambert's Point rail terminal. An important question is how those measurements will be used to assess risks to the local residents. It will be important to try to estimate the cumulative impact of all pollutants and to try to extend that assessment back in time. After all, the coal trains have been coming through the Lambert's Point neighborhoods for decades. Unfortunately, DEQ's measurements won't capture buildup of coal-related contaminants in the soil. The analysis must account for the following factors: long-term exposures to fine particulate matter and to carcinogens like arsenic, particulate matter's inequitable impacts on minorities and those with low income, and the pre-existing burden of adverse health effects imposed by racist practices. Surely, DEQ's analysts will have fresh in mind a 2020 federal court decision that revoked an air pollution permit, in part because DEQ and the State Air Pollution Control Board had ignored disproportionate impacts on African Americans. Earlier this summer, I asked Carl Poole to describe what he knew about DEQ's air pollution study and about how DEQ was communicating with the community about that study. He said he and Sierra Club representatives met in the spring with representatives from DEQ.
Now, initially, it sounded to me over the course of that conversation that they were thinking we're going to do a lot of outreach electronically, maybe have like Zoom meetings or send emails or calls to people. But one thing that I know I personally try to emphasize is that when it comes to Lambert's Point and when it comes to just communities most affected in the area, you're not going to get people's attention unless you go into those communities. You have face-to-face meetings. You reach out to them where they live. And if you do that, you'll get a better response. That was a message that we kind of all pushed during that meeting. And it was a good thing to hear them during that meeting sound as if they were going to include that and put that in a piece for their plan.
After that meeting, Carl and the Sierra Club members followed up with a letter to DEQ. They asked technical questions about the process for deciding things like where to establish the monitors and about how DEQ would communicate with community members.
We sent that letter out to them and we got a response, and it still kind of feels like they don't have a lot laid out. They still kind of have an outline for community outreach. what the question that we went at that we one big question that we asked was, you know, if you do find air quality issues, if you do find things, you know, going above the federal standard, what is your response going to be? They kept saying that this would be a hard question for us to answer. They're real vague on trying to say, yeah, we're going to take care of this. And their reasoning is pretty simple because, you know, it's kind of, you know, a hypothetical. But it just felt like their response was doing everything it could to avoid the fact that the only real potential culprit when it comes to any problems with the air around Lambert's Point or in that part of Norfolk, period, is Norfolk Southern. Yes, you have a major road running by, and there's lots of truck traffic on Hampton Boulevard, but air monitors more than likely won't be placed on Hampton Boulevard to check air quality. They're going to be placed within the neighborhoods in Lambert's Point, in Lodgemount, in West Ghent, and all of these places have one thing in common. They are bordering the rail line that Norfolk Southern has. The biggest polluter around, potentially, is sitting right next door to those neighborhoods. Their response is showing us that they haven't got their act together just yet when it comes to how they're going to communicate with the community. One of the things that came up in the meeting in April was that the whole community outreach, whether we're talking sending flyers to people's houses or whether you're talking about meetings of for local folks in the area, was a thing that was kind of going to start over the course of the summer. At least that was the thing that was implied.
As of now, late August, Carl is still waiting to hear from DEQ. Now, I'll introduce you to some ideas that will help you recognize how power is wielded in ways that bias policy decisions in favor of the powerful. We'll learn about the three faces of power, and I'll apply those ideas in the Rhoda and Lambert's Point situations. Let's start with Dr. John Gaventa's thoughtful work on power relations, which I mentioned in the second episode of Season 2, Power Wears Many Disguises. Dr. Gaventa's award-winning 1980 book, Power and Powerlessness, Quiescence and Rebellion in an Appalachian Valley, is still read widely. Dr. Gaventa is with the Institute for Development Studies at the University of Sussex in the UK. This excerpt is from a YouTube video featuring a 2010 workshop that Dr. Gaventa did for the Global Network of Civil Society Organizations for Disaster Reduction.
Three different dimensions of power. The first one here, visible power. Some people say you can tell who has power by looking at who's participating in a decision-making arena, and you see whose voices prevail and whose voices are ignored. And based on that, you say, oh, in this community or in this country, those people seem to have a lot of power because their voices are heard more. But those people who've studied power have said, no, that's not the only way power works. There's a second kind of power, which is called hidden power. And hidden power is the ability to keep certain people or certain issues from getting into that visible space in the first place. You may have a meeting, and one dimension of power is who's speaking in that meeting and who's prevailing and who's deciding. But another dimension is asking who's not even at this meeting. What are the barriers that are keeping those voices and their knowledge and their issues out of this, we're off the table altogether. So if you're trying to change power, you have to ask who participates inside the decision-making arena, but you also have to ask who's not there that ought to be there, and how can we get their voices into the process? How can we overcome the barriers by giving them the knowledge, by setting the meetings and a time they can attend, by doing it in the right language?
Okay, let's stop there and just consider the first and second faces of power. How might we apply these ideas to the cases of dust pollution in Rhoda and Lambert's Point? In the first phase of power, political wins and losses are visible and traceable to specific actors. Theoretically, this is where citizen environmental boards can play an important role. They provide spaces in which citizens' voices can be heard by other citizens, that is, the board members. Citizen boards in Virginia make decisions in public, and they're supposed to invite public input. That being said, even with policy decisions made in full public view, business interests carry considerable weight. We Air Board members were pushed many times to back down and write less strict standards. And in the state legislature in the 1990s, Norfolk Southern was able to convince state legislators that covering rail cars would be financially crippling. one is put in mind of Mr. Minx's frustration in trying to call attention to the public health risks associated with the coal dust at Lambert's Point. As Dr. Gavent points out, even when we can see such visible processes at work in public, there are hidden ways in which power expresses itself as well. The second phase of power involves processes that exclude some voices or information from the decision-making process. I would imagine that Carl Poole is feeling the force of that power right now as he waits to hear when DEQ will actively involve local residents in the study's design and implementation. Rota residents had to travel 400 miles to be heard at the board's meetings in Richmond. Environmental officials in Virginia and elsewhere have failed to incorporate into their decisions the fact that income and race-related factors magnify susceptibility to air pollution's health effects. The second phase of power also manifests itself when a policy agenda is constrained to eliminate what might be otherwise viable options. That's what happened in Rota when state officials resisted the very idea of writing a regulation that would control dust flying from coal trucks, even though the board had the authority to do so. It was only because of the petition from the Sierra Club and Southern Appalachian Mountain stewards that the possibility of a regulation landed squarely on our agenda. Finally, people can be excluded from environmental decisions because of the highly technical language surrounding those decisions. I remember well the steep learning curve I encountered when I was a young air pollution analyst at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. It took a long time to become comfortable with the scientific, engineering, legal terms common in air pollution parlance. In my experience, it's often white males who are considered the most authoritative when speaking about such issues. Those of us who aren't white males can sometimes struggle to find a legitimate place at the table. Here's Dr. Gaventa on the third face of power.
But then the theorist of power said, wait a minute, there's a third form of power. And that's what we call invisible power. So invisible power is the internalization of powerlessness so that people don't even realize they have the right to a voice in the first place. Okay, so hidden power is when the power that is keeping issues off the table, but people are aware, and they're aware of their voice, and they can't get to the table. So something is a blockage there. Invisible power is when people aren't even aware of their issues, of their voice, of their rights to speak.
The third phase of power, invisible power, operates the most subtly of the three. It happens when people change their outlook without their conscious knowledge because they encounter a powerful opponent again and again. People in communities with a history of oppression might come to believe that they are powerless to change the status quo. To take another example of the third phase of power at work, while on the board, I felt that DEQ staff shrank from taking action that displeased polluting companies because of long-standing, silent understandings. This is not just idle speculation. In the 1990s, not long before I was appointed to the board, some DEQ staff confessed in a report to the state's legislature that they feared retaliation if they challenged polluting companies with strict standards. In Rota, DEQ staff denied the very possibility of high particulate matter pollution caused by those coal trucks. It was as if they didn't want to see those high particulate matter levels. In many such situations, the powerful come to assume that their views will prevail and that their ideas will be regarded as the most legitimate. Those in inferior positions, like civil servants, defer to those in power and allow themselves to be coerced because they assume that's the natural order. In my book, Climate of Capitulation, I pointed out that Virginia's traditionalistic political culture contributes to the acceptance of an order in which polluting sources are viewed as the ultimate authority on how they should be regulated. Traditionalistic political cultures in the U.S. South are inseparable from the region's long history of racism and slaveholding. Since the civil rights era, as political processes and participation have become more open to African Americans and other minorities, subtler kinds of framings have helped maintain the status quo. Only sustained, strong leadership and the calling out of these kinds of embedded biases can change long-standing power dynamics in the environmental policy arena. I have seen such leadership in action. I know it can happen and that it can work. Virginia's leaders have said they'll prioritize environmental justice. We must hold them to that promise for the sake of socially vulnerable communities like Rhoda and Lambert's Point. I'm Vivian Thompson. Thank you for listening to The Meaning of Green, Season 3.